Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 86. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you Friend Island by Francis Stevens, narrated by Peter Falico. Francis Stevens is the pseudonym for Gertrude Barrows Bennett, considered to be the first major female writer of fantasy and science fiction in the United States, and has been called the woman who invented dark fantasy. Regular listeners of the show will recall the extended biography I gave in episode 83 for her story Elf Trap, so I'll be brief. Born in Minneapolis in 1883, Gertrude had her first story accepted for publication in Argosy in 1904, when she was just 17. But it wasn't until she began caring for her invalid mother in 1909 that she returned to writing in earnest. She died in 1948, leaving a remarkable legacy. She is thought to have influenced both H.P. Lovecraft and A. Merritt, who we'll hear more from next week, and was described by critic Sam Moskowitz as the greatest woman writer of science fiction in the period between Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley and C.L. Moore. Peter Falico DJs jazz radio shows in the San Francisco and Monterey Bay areas. His efforts have been heard on radio stations KKUP, KPEN, KUSP, KRML, and KCSM. His show The Doodlin' Lounge places emphasis on the Blue Note recording artists and hard bop grooves, and is available, along with other shows, as podcasts from his website, www.doodlinlounge.com. He's also one of the hosts of Evening Jazz on KCSM, the Bay Area's jazz station, which you can find at www.kcsm.org. Along with his radio broadcasts and home studio podcasts, Peter has been involved in the voiceover business since 1985. He's also the founder and executive director of a non-profit organization called the Jazz Organ Fellowship, and the owner of his own record label, Doodlin' Records. Pete's been on the show twice before. Check out Hell on Dirt Oval in episode 24 and A Man's Problem in episode 69. So get ready for a romantic tale with a twist. We're travelling to Friend Island by Francis Stevens, narrated by Peter Falico.
It was upon the waterfront that I first met her, in one of the shabby little tea shops frequented by able sailoresses of the poorer type. The uptown glittering resorts of the Lady Aviators Union were not for such as she. Stern of feature, bronzed by wind and sun, her age could only be guessed, but I surmised at once that in her I beheld a survivor of the age of turbines and oil engines, a true seawoman of that elder time, when women's superiority to man had not been so long recognized, when, to emphasize their victory, women in all ranks were sterner than today's need demands. The spruce, smiling young maidens, engine women and stokers of the great aluminum rollers, but despite their profession, very neat in gold-braided blue knickers and boleros, these looked askance at the hard-faced relic of a harsher day as they passed in and out of the shop. I, however, brazenly ignoring similar glances at myself, a mere male intruding on the haunts of the world's ruling sex, drew a chair up beside the veteran. I ordered a full pot of tea, 2 cups, and a plate of macaroons, and put on my most ingratiating air. Possibly my unconcealed admiration and interest were wiles not exercised in vain. Or the macaroons and tea, both excellent, may have loosened the old seawoman's tongue. At any rate, under cautious questioning, she had soon launched upon a series of reminiscences well beyond my hopes for color and variety. "When I was a lass," quoth the seawoman after a time, "there was none of this high-flying, gilt-edged, leather-stocking luxury about the sea. We sailed by the power of our oil and gasoline. If they failed on us, like as not 'twas the rubber ring, and the rolling wave for ours. She referred to the archaic practice of placing a pneumatic affair called a life preserver beneath the arms in case of that dreaded disaster now so unheard of, shipwreck. In them days, there was still many a man bold enough to join our crews, and I've knowed cases, she added condescendingly, where just by the muscle and brawn of such men, some poor sailor lass has reached shore alive that would have fed the sharks without 'em. Oh, I ain't so down on men as you might think. It's the spoiling of them that I don't hold with. There's too much preached nowadays that man is fit for nothing but to fetch and carry and do nurse work in big child homes. To my mind, a man who hasn't the nerve of a woman ain't fitted to father children, let alone raise 'em. But that's not here nor there. My time's past, and I know it, or I wouldn't be sitting here gossiping to you, my lad, over an empty teapot. I took the hint, and with our cups replenished, she bit thoughtfully into her 14th macaroon and continued. There's one voyage I'm not likely to forget, though I live to be as old as Captain Mary Barnacle of the Shouter. 'Twas aboard the old Shouter that this here voyage occurred, and it was her last and likewise Captain Mary's. Captain Mary, she was then that decrepit, it seemed a mercy that she should go to her rest, and in good salt water at that. I remember the voyage for Captain Mary's sake, but most I remember it because 'twas then that I came the nighest in my life to committing matrimony. For a man, the man had nerve. He was near being companionable than any other man I ever seed, and if it hadn't been for just one little event that showed up the mannishness of him, in a way, I couldn't abide. I reckon he'd be keeping house for me this minute. We cleared from Frisco with a cargo of silketeen petticoats for Brisbane. Captain Mary was always strong on petticoats. Leather breeches or even half-skirts would have paid far better, they being more in demand, like, but Captain Mary was three-quarters owner, and says she, land women should buy petticoats, and if they didn't, it wouldn't be the Lord's fault nor hers for not providing them. We cleared on a fine day, which is an all sign, or was, then when the weather and the seas, O God, still counted in the trafficking of the humankind. Not 2 days out, we met a whirling, mucking bouncer of a gale that well nigh threw the old Shouter a full point off her course in the first wallop. She was a stout craft, though. None of your featherweight, gas-lightened, paper-thin alloy shells, but toughened aluminum from stern to stern. Her turbine drove her through the combers at a 45-knot clip, which named her a speedy craft for a freighter in them days. But this night, as we tore along through the creaming green billows, something unknown went way wrong down below. I was forward, under the shelter of her long oversloop, looking for a hairpin I'd dropped somewheres about that afternoon. It was a gold hairpin, and gold, still being mighty scarce when I was a girl, of course I valued it. But suddenly I felt the old Shouter give a jump under my feet like a plane struck by a shell in full flight. Then she trembled all over for a full second, frightened-like. Then with the crash of doomsday ringing in my ears, I felt myself sailing through the air right into the teeth of the shrieking gale, as near as I could judge. Down I come in the hollow of a monstrous big wave, and as my ears doused under, I thought I heard a splash close by. Coming up, sure enough, there close by me was floating a new patent hermetic thermo ice chest. Being as it was empty, and being as it was shut up airtight, that ice chest made as sweet a life preserver as a woman could wish in such an hour. About 10 foot by 12, it floated high in the raging sea. Out on its top I scrambled, and hanging on by a handle, I looked expectant for some of my poor fellow women to come floating by, which they never did, for the good reason that the shouter had blowed up and went below, petticoats, Cap'n Mary, and all. "What caused the explosion?" I inquired. "The Lord and Cap'n Mary Barnacle can explain," she answered piously. "Besides the oil for her turbines, she carried a power of gasoline for her alternative engines, and likely 'twas the cause of her ending so sudden-like. Anyways, all I ever seen of her again was the empty ice chest that Providence had well-nigh hove upon my head. On that I sat and floated and floated and sat some more, till by and by the storm sort of blowed itself out, the sun come shining, this was next morning, and I could dry my hair and look about me. I was a young lass then, and not bad to look upon. I didn't want to die any more than you that's sitting there this minute, so I up and prays for land. Sure enough, toward evening, a speck heaves up low down on the horizon. At first, I took it for a gas liner, but later found it was just a little island, all alone by itself in the great Pacific Ocean. Come now, here's luck, thinks I, and with that I deserts the ice chest, which being empty, and me having no ice to put in it, not likely to have in them latitudes, is of no further use to me. Striking out, I swum a mile or so, and set foot on dry land for the first time in nigh 3 days. Pretty land it were, too, though bare of human life as an iceberg in the Arctic. I had landed on a shining white beach that run up to a grove of lovely waving palm trees. Above them, I could see the slopes of a hill so high and green, it reminded me of my own old home up near Kookwagomoc Lake in Maine. The whole place just seemed to smile and smile at me. The palms waved and bowed in the sweet breeze, like they wanted to say, "Just set right down and make yourself to home. We've been waiting a long time for you to come." I cried. I was that happy to be made welcome. I was a young lass then, and sensitive-like to how folks treated me. You're laughing now, but wait and see if or not there was sense to the way I felt. So I up and dries my clothes and my long, soft hair again, which was well worth drying, for I had far more of it than now. After that, I walked along a piece until there was a sweet little path meandering away into the wild woods. Here, thinks I, this looks like inhabitants. Be they civil or wild, I wonder? But after traveling the path a piece, lo and behold, it ended sudden-like in a wide circle of green grass with a little spring of clear water, and the first thing I noticed was a slab of white board nailed to a palm tree close to the spring. Right off, I took a long drink, for you better believe I was thirsty, and then I went to look at this board. It had evidently been tore off the side of a wooden packing box, and the letters were roughly printed in lead pencil. "Heaven help whoever you be," I read. "This island ain't just right. I'm going to swim for it. You better too. Goodbye, Nelson Smith." That's what it said, but the spelling was simply awful. It all looked quite new and recent, as if Nelson Smith hadn't more than a few hours before he wrote and nailed it there. Well, after reading that queer warning, I begun to shake all over like in a chill. Yes, I shook like I had the ague, though the hot tropic sun was burning down right on me and that alarming board. What had scared Nelson Smith so much that he had to swim to get away? I looked all around, real cautious and careful, but not a single frightening thing could I behold. And the palms and the green grass and the flowers still smiled that peaceful and friendly-like. "Just make yourself to home" was wrote all over the place in plainer letters than those sprawling lead pencil ones on the board. Pretty soon, what with the quiet and all, the chill left me. Then I thought, well, to be sure, this Smith person was just an ordinary man, I reckon, and likely he had got nervous being so alone. Likely he just fancied things, which was really not. It's a pity he drowned himself before I come, though likely I'd have found him poor company. By his record, I judge him a man of but common education. So I decided to make the most of my welcome, and that I did for weeks to come. Right near the spring was a cave, dry as a biscuit box, with a nice floor of white sand. Nelson had lived there, too, for there was a litter of stuff, tin cans, empty, scraps of newspapers, and the like. I got to calling him Nelson in my mind, and then Nellie, and wondering if he was dark or fair, and how he come to be cast away there all alone, and what was the strange events that drove him to his end. I cleaned out the cave, though. He had devoured all his tin-canned provisions, however he come by them, but this I didn't mind. That there island was a generous body. Green milk coconuts, sweet berries, turtle eggs, and the like was my daily fare. For about 3 weeks, the sun shone every day, the birds sang, and the monkeys chattered. We was all one big happy family, and the more I explored that island, the better I liked the company I was keeping. The land was about 10 miles from beach to beach, and never a foot of it that wasn't sweet and clean as a private park. From the top of the hill, I could see the ocean, miles and miles of blue water, with never a sign of a gas liner or even a little government running boat. Them running boats used to go most everywhere to keep the seaways clean of derelicts and the like. But I knowed that if this island was no more than 100 miles off the regular courses of navigation, it might be many a long day before I'd be rescued. The top of the hill, as I found when first I climbed up there, was a wore-out crater. So I knowed that the island was one of them volcanic ones you run across so many of in the seas between Capricorn and Cancer. Here and there, on the slopes and down through the jungly tree growth, I would come on great lumps of rock. And these must have came up out of that crater long ago. If there was lava, it was so old it had been covered up entire with green growing stuff. You couldn't have found it without a spade, which I didn't have nor want. Well, at first I was happy as the hours was long. I wandered and clambered and waded and swum and combed my long hair on the beach, having fortunately not lost my side combs nor the rest of my gold hairpins. But by and by, it begun to get just a bit lonesome. Funny thing, that's a feeling that, once it starts, it gets worse and worser so quick, it's perfectly surprising. And right then, when the days begun to get gloomy, we had a long, sickly hot spell like I never seen before on an ocean island. There was dull clouds across the sun from morn to night. Even the little monkeys and parakeets that had seemed so gay moped and drowsed like they was sick. All one day I cried, and let the rain soak me through and through. That was the first rain we had, and I didn't get thorough dried even during the night, though I slept in my cave. Next morning I got up mad as thunder at myself and all the world. When I looked out, the black clouds was billowing across the sky. I could hear nothing but great breakers roaring in on the beaches, and the wild wind raving through the lashing palms. As I stood there, a nasty little wet monkey dropped from a branch almost on my head. I grabbed a pebble and slung it at him real vicious. "Get away, you dirty little brute!" I shrieks. And with that, there come an awful blinding flare of light. There was a long, crackling noise like a bunch of Chinese firecrackers, and then a sound as if a whole fleet of shouters had all went up together. When I come to, I found myself way in the back of my cave, trying to dig further into the rock with my fingernails. Upon taking thought, it come to me that what had occurred was just a lightning clap, and going to look, sure enough, there lay a big palm tree right across the glade. It was all busted and split open by the lightning, and the little monkey was under it, for I could see his tail and his hind legs sticking out. Now, when I set eyes on that poor, crushed little beast I'd been so mean to, I was terrible ashamed. I sat down on the smashed tree and considered how thankful I had ought to have been. Here I had a lovely, plenteous island with food and water to my taste, when it might have been a barren starvation rock that was my lot. And so, thinking a sort of gradual peaceful feeling stole over me. I got cheerfuler and cheerfuler, till I could have sang and danced for joy. Pretty soon I realized that the sun was shining bright for the first time that week. The wind had stopped hollering, and the waves had died to just a singing murmur on the beach. It seemed kind of, oh, strange, this sudden peace, like the cheer in my own heart after its rage and storm. I rose up, feeling sort of queer, and went to look if the little monkey had came alive again. Though that was a fool thing, seeing he was laying all crushed up and very dead, I buried him under a tree root, and as I did it, a conviction come to me. I didn't hardly question that conviction at all. Somehow, living there alone so long, perhaps my natural womanly intuition was stronger than ever before or since, and so I knowed. Then I went and pulled poor Nelson Smith's board off from the tree and tossed it away for the tide to carry off. That there board was an insult to my island. The sea woman paused, and her eyes had a faraway look. It seemed as if I, and perhaps even the macaroons and tea, were quite forgotten. "Why did you think that?" I asked, to bring her back. "How could an island be insulted?" She started, passed her hand across her eyes, and hastily poured another cup of tea. "Because," she said at last, poising a macaroon in midair, "because that island, that particular island that I had landed on, had a heart. When I was gay, it was bright and cheerful. It was glad when I come, and it treated me right, until I got that grouchy it had to mope from sympathy. It loved me like a friend. When I flung a rock at that poor little drenched monkey critter, it backed up my act with an anger like the wrath of God, and killed its own child to please me. But it got right cheery the minute I seen the wrongness of my ways. Nelson Smith had no business to say, 'This island ain't just right,' for it was a righter place than ever I seen elsewhere. When I cast away that lying board, all the birds begun to sing like mad. The green milk coconuts fell right and left. Only the monkeys seemed kind of sad, like still, and no wonder. You see, their own mother, the island, had rounded on one of them for my sake. After that, I was right careful and considerate. I named the island Anita, not knowing her right name or if she had any. Anita was a pretty name, and it sounded kind of South Sea-like. Anita and me got along real well together from that day on. It was some strain to be always gay and singing around like a dear duck of a canary bird, but I'd done my best. Still, for all the love and gratitude I bore Anita, the company of an island, however sympathetic, ain't quite enough for a human being. I still got lonesome. There was even days when I couldn't keep the clouds clear out of the sky, though I will say we had no more tornadoes. I think the island understood and tried to help me with all the bounty and good cheer the poor thing possessed. Nonetheless, my heart gave a wonderful big leap when one day I seen a blot on the horizon. It drawed nearer and nearer, until at last I could make out its nature. 'A ship, of course,' said I. 'And were you rescued?' 'Tweren't a ship neither,' denied the sea woman somewhat impatiently. 'Can't you let me spin this yarn without no more remarks and fool questions? This thing, what was bearing down so fast with the incoming tide, was neither more nor less than another island. You may well look startled. I was startled myself, much more so than you likely. I didn't know then what you, with your book learning, very likely know now, that islands sometimes float, their underparts being a tangled up mess of roots and old vines that new stuffs growed over. They sometimes break away from the mainland in a brisk gale and go off for a voyage, calm as an old-fashioned eight-funnel steamer. This one was uncommon large, being as much as 2 miles, maybe, from shore to shore. It had its palm trees and its live things just like my own Anita, and I've sometimes wondered if this drifting piece hadn't really been a part of my island once, just its daughter-like, as you might say. Be that, however, as it might be, no sooner did the floating piece get within hailing distance than I hears a human holler, and there was a man dancing up and down on the shore like he was plumb crazy. Next minute, he had plunged into the narrow strip of water between us, and in a few minutes had swum to where I stood. Yes, of course, it was none other than Nelson Smith. I knowed that the minute I set eyes on him. He had the very look of not having no better sense than the man what wrote that board and then nearly committed suicide trying to get away from the best island in all the oceans. Glad enough he was to get back, though, for the coconuts was running very short on the floater what had rescued him, and the turtle eggs wasn't worth mentioning. Being short of grub is the surest way I know to cure a man's fear of the unknown. Well, to make a long story short, Nelson Smith told me he was an aeronator. In them days, to be an aeronator was not the same as to be an aviatrist is now. There was dangers in the air and dangers in the sea, and he had met with both. His gas tank had leaked, and he had dropped into the water close by Anita. A case or two of provisions was all he could save from the total wreck. Now, as you might guess, I was crazy enough to find out what had scared this Nelson Smith into trying to swim the Pacific. He told me a story that seemed to fit pretty well with mine, only when it come to the scary part, he shut up like a clam, that aggravating way some men have. I give it up at last, for just man foolishness, and we begun to scheme to get away. Anita moped some while we talked it over. I realized how she must be feeling, so I explained to her that it was right needful for us to get with our kind again. If we stayed with her, we should probably quarrel like cats, and maybe even kill each other out of pure human cussedness. She cheered up considerably after that, and even, I thought, got a little anxious to have us leave. At any rate, when we begun to provision up the little floater, which we had anchored to the big island by a cable of twisted bark, the green nuts fell all over the ground, and Nelson found more turtle nests in a day than I had in weeks. During them days, I really got fond of Nelson Smith. He was a companionable body and brave, or he wouldn't have been a professional aeronauter, a job that was rightly thought tough enough for a woman, let alone a man. Though he was not so well educated as me, at least he was quiet and modest about what he did know, not like some men, boasting most where there is least to brag of. Indeed, I misdoubt if Nelson and me would not have quit the sea and the air together and set up housekeeping in some quiet little town up in New England, maybe, after we had got away, if it had not been for what happened when we went. I never, let me say, was so deceived in any man before nor since. The thing taught me a lesson, and I never was fooled again. We was all ready to go, and then one morning, like a parting gift from Anita, come a soft and favoring wind. Nelson and I run down the beach together, for we didn't want our floater to blow off and leave us. As we was running, our arms full of coconuts, Nelson Smith stubbed his bare toe on a sharp rock, and down he went. I hadn't noticed and was going on. But suddenly, the ground begun to shake under my feet, and the air was full of a queer, grinding, groaning sound, like the very earth was in pain. I turned around sharp. There sat Nelson, holding his bleeding toe in both fists and giving vent to such awful words as no decent sea-going lady would ever speak nor hear to. "Stop it, stop it," I shrieked at him, but 'twas too late. Island or no island, Anita was a lady too. She had a gentle heart, but she knowed how to behave when she was insulted. With one terrible, great roar, a spout of smoke and flame belched up out of the heart of Anita's crater hill a full mile into the air. I guess Nelson stopped swearing. He couldn't have heard himself anyways. Anita was talking now with tongues of flame and such roars as would have bespoke the raging protest of a continent. I grabbed that fool man by the hand and run him down to the water. We had to swim good and hard to catch up with our only hope, the floater. No bark rope could hold her against the stiff breeze that was now blowing, and she had broke her cable. By the time we scrambled aboard, great rocks were falling right and left. We couldn't see each other for a while, for the clouds of fine gray ash. It seemed like Anita was that mad she was flinging stones after us, and truly I believe that such was her intention. I didn't blame her, neither. Lucky for us, the wind was strong, and we was soon out of range. "So," says I to Nelson, after I got most of the ashes out of my mouth and shook my hair clear of cinders, "so that was the reason you up and left sudden when you was there before. You aggravated that island till the poor thing drove you out." "Well," says he, and not so meek as I'd have admired to see him, "how could I know the darn island was a lady?" "Actions speak louder than words," says I. "You should have known it by her ladylike behavior." "Is volcanoes and slinging hot rocks ladylike?" he says. "Is snakes ladylike? T'other the time I cut my thumb on a tin can, I cussed a little bit. Say, just a little bit. And what comes at me out of all the caves and out of every crack in the rocks and out of the very spring of water where I'd been drinking? Why, snakes. Snakes, if you please. Big, little, green, red, and sky blue, scarlet. What'd I do? Jumped in the water, of course. Why wouldn't I? I'd rather swim and drown than be stung or swallowed to death. But how was I to know the snakes come out of the rocks because I cussed?" "You couldn't, I agrees, sarcastic. Some folks never knows a lady till she up and whangs them over the head with a brick. A real gentle, kind-like warning them snakes were, which you would not heed. Take shame to yourself, Nelly," says I, right stern, "that a decent little island like Anita can't associate with you peacefully. But you must hurt her sacredest feelings with language no lady would stand by to hear." I never did see Anita again. She may have blew herself right out of the ocean in her just wrath at the vulgar, disgusting language of Nelson Smith. I don't know. We was took off the floater at last, and I lost track of Nelson just as quick as I could when we was landed at Frisco. He had taught me a lesson. A man is just full of mannishness, and the best of 'em ain't good enough for a lady to sacrifice her sensibilities to put up with. Nelson Smith, he seemed to feel real bad when he learned I was not for him, and then he apologized. But apologies weren't no use to me. I could never abide him after the way he went and talked right in the presence of me and my poor sweet lady friend Anita. Now, I am well versed in the lore of the sea in all ages. Through mists of time, I have enviously eyed wild voyagings of sea rovers who roved and spun their yarns before the stronger sex came into its own and ousted man from his heroic pedestal. I have followed across the printed page the wanderings of Odysseus. Before Gulliver, I have burned the incense of tranced attention and with reverent awe considered the history of one Munchausen, a baron. But alas, these were only men. In what field is not woman our subtle superior? Meekly, I bowed my head, and when my eyes dared lift again, the ancient Marinus had departed, leaving me to sorrow for my surpassed and outdone idols. Also with a bill of macaroons and tea of such incredible proportions, that in comparison therewith I found it easy to believe her story.
That was Friend Island by Francis Stevens, narrated by Peter Falico. In every iteration of the Star Trek franchise, there's at least one episode that deals with a matriarchal society. Next Generation has Angel One, and Deep Space Nine has the Skria in Sanctuary, for example. Interestingly, these are not popular episodes, and I think it comes from the clumsy, self-conscious way they handle the reversal, often as a metaphor for some other social ill. Angel One was attempting to reference South African apartheid, for example. Our story takes a more subtle approach, I think, with no cute gimmicks or twist. Our gruff old seafarer just happens to be a woman, and her fickle, careless love interest, a man. It's a thought-provoking and fun layer that we can explore independent of the entertaining pulp adventure it's couched in. Speculative fiction often touches on sensitive topics with its speculation, and gender is one of the most sensitive. Let us know what you thought of this week's topic by leaving a comment on our site at protectingprojectpulp.com or joining the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site menu. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrandt. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 87, where we'll bring you Through the Dragon Glass by A. Merritt. So let us not forget that elder time when women's superiority to man had not been so long recognised, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.